Welcome back, everyone, to the third episode of the Unlearning of Child Welfare podcast. I'm Jaquoia Wilson, and in this episode, I'm joined again by Sandra Gonzalez, as well as a panel of family well-being advocates, including Matt Anderson, Director at Institute for Family, Bobby Taylor, the Strengthening Families Coordinator for the Nebraska Children and Families Foundation, Suzanne Shore, the First Lady of Nebraska, who has been involved in several statewide initiatives, and Ned Breslin, CEO of Tennyson Center for Children and founder of Rewiring. This episode is all about the how behind building a family well-being approach in the child welfare system, as well as touching on some emerging efforts from across the country. Let's begin the dialogue.
In our last episode, we introduced to you all the idea of unlearning child welfare language and reinventing that with something like family well-being. I think that really just leaves us with the question that we are trying to really help answer today. And that's, you know, the how behind a lot of what we're doing and how do we plan on moving forward and seeing each state kind of take on the same vision and having a family well-being focused child welfare system.
And today's webinar will really focus on how some places are already taking up the work in different ways. So you're going to hear both Colorado and Nebraska as examples of what they're doing. Both of these states are a part of the Thriving Families, Safer Children effort, which is a national commitment to well-being that really aims to move from traditional reactive child protection systems to those designed to support child and family well-being and prevent child maltreatment and unnecessary family separations. And you heard about that at the last webinar. But both of these examples are also a part of local efforts, the Rewiring Collaborative in Colorado and the Bring Up Nebraska Initiative. You'll hear about those. So today you're going to learn about early indicators of how we can begin to build the family well-being approach from the ground up. You'll also learn about some emerging family well-being efforts across the country from one of our panelists. And so that is what today really is. It's a conversation. We intentionally wanted to have a dialogue. It won't be a presentation. And we want you to learn from the various perspectives about how to make this shift.
So I'm going to start with you, Ned, if that's okay, and just ask, can you give a brief overview of Rewiring and Bring Up Nebraska? Like, what are these initiatives and what exactly are you trying to accomplish? Like, you know, what personally motivated you to take on this work? So I know it's a loaded question, Ned, but I know you have a lot to say. So I'm going to pass the mic to you.
Well, thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here. What motivated me is I joined Tennyson about 3.5-4 years ago, and we're a pretty small and traditional child welfare provider. We have a residential program. We have a community-based program. We have a day treatment program and, you know, great staff, great program, great history. We've been around since 1904. And all the kids who come here are amazing. You know, I was just with a kid who was in our residential program for a while. He's now in a foster family, but the school wouldn't let him in. They thought he was too risky. And he's 9 and he's upset about that. And he is pounding away educationally because he's going to prove to that school that he's worthy, you know, and it's shocking that a 9-year-old has to prove that they're worthy. But what's particularly galling about this is that even though he was in our residential program, if you look at his case history, the thing that makes me so sad is if someone had actually moved earlier, he wouldn't be at Tennyson. He wouldn't have been in our residential program. And while I'm thrilled to know him and I love him to death, I wish I didn't know him. I shouldn't know him. Rewiring is a very simple idea. And it basically says, and it frames the work in terms of impact and outcomes. And so it basically says the sector, child welfare, whether it's state, local, national, is spending an enormous amount of money buying terrible outcomes. And what we keep doing is trying to pound money different ways and add services in different ways. And we're still getting abysmal outcomes. The other thing that's galling about it is if you talk to any caseworker, they will sit there and they will say, you know, I saw this family today and they're in real trouble, but you know what? I can't do anything. They haven't met medical necessity or imminent risk qualifications. I can't figure out how to move funding. And so I have to wait for them to fail. That's immoral. That's absolutely immoral. And so caseworkers have that story all over the country. Rewiring basically said is, well, that's nuts. What would you do if we actually eliminated the problems of medical necessity and imminent risk as a funding line, and anything below it you can move, but anything above it is kind of harder to move. What if we said, we're going to buy different outcomes? We're going to invest programmatically, financially. We're going to invest to see if we dramatically reduce the number of children and families who become child welfare involved. And we're going to see if we could get better results for the children who are child welfare because of that. And the rewiring part is to understand how money moves so we can go to legislators and budget writers and say, move the money this way to buy these outcomes instead of continuing to move the money this way and buying garbage outcomes. We started it in Colorado, and a lot of heroes in this story, but it was co-designed by this colleague of mine, Tiffany Perrin from the Zoma Foundation. A lot of people sit around and say, donors want to get involved in the design and everything. This is a perfect example of it. Tiffany co-designed it with us. She was so impactful that we actually convinced the donor to give her to us for 3 years so that she could actually see the impact of her work. And then we went to the Joint Budget Committee, where another gifted magician, the budget analyst there, Robin Smart, who cares about kids more than anyone I know, basically said, let me see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying you're going to use philanthropic dollars to show how money moves differently to reduce the number of children and families becoming child welfare involved and get better results in the counties that we work with. We identified 10 counties across Colorado, east, west, north, south, Republican, Democrat, high density, low density, diverse, not so diverse. And she basically said, if you can show me that you can get better results moving money, then I will help you rewire the money. And so we started. We started about a year ago. The 10 counties are unbelievable. And we basically said, we're not going to make you plan over plan and do a proposal and do all that stuff. It's iterative. What are the drivers in your county that are leading to child welfare involvement? And so county sat back and they said, well, in our county, it might be prenatal moms, substance using, who we don't want to do that anymore. And substance treatment programs aren't solving the problem. Or it could be third graders, fourth graders, seventh graders, 10th graders in our schools who are starting to struggle. So all these counties came up with these ideas of like, if I had the ability to invest, I would go here. They've done five things across these 10 counties. They have built programs that reduce isolation. So they've invested in some crazy things. One of them, my favorite, is called granny armies. It's basically rural communities that are never going to have enough social workers. But what do they have? They have grandmothers, and grandmothers are trusted, and grandmothers have lost their sense of purpose. And so we're now matching grandmothers with prenatal moms, and they will stay with those moms till the kid's 5 years old so that those kids don't become child welfare involved. We have massively invested in basic needs, housing, transport, childcare, all of that. Anyone who's non-TANF eligible but is struggling and child welfare has seen them, we're moving on that. We have two counties, Denver and Larimer, who've identified the zip codes in their counties with the highest referrals. So instead, in those counties, instead of going and saying your family's got a problem and your family was referred, you sit back and facilitate a community level. Why are there so many referrals here? And you finance local community-based organizations who are trusted, who are known. They don't like Tennyson. They don't want to see Tennyson. We're investing in other organizations to do that. Amazing triage work in Douglas County. Real hats off to the Douglas County team. One of the biggest drivers into child welfare are schools. And so what they've done is put a layer between the schools, because when the schools don't know what to do, they call DHS. So they put a layer between the schools and said, call them first and let's see if they actually do need DHS or they should go somewhere else. Last thing is medical necessity and imminent risk work. So we've had organizations like Tennyson and Savio take in Douglas County, there are 2,000 families that Douglas County DHS sees. They estimate 48% will be child welfare involved in 2 years. That's 960. Give us those 2,000 families. Let's go work with them. And let's see if instead of 960 families, we can get it down to 50 or 40 or 10. We then frame all of that work in terms of cost avoidance. If they had become child welfare involved, what would that have cost? $14,000 per case. How much are we saving by cutting the number of children and families who become child welfare involved? After a year, zero families that this program has worked with, zero have become child welfare involved. That is telling. The second part of rewiring is to say, we got to get better results in the system. And so real quickly, what we're doing is we've jumped all over the QRTP work. We think the most brilliant part of FFPSA is the assessment link. And we set up a program that said, stop putting kids in residential. Any kid that you're worried about, you can put that kid in Tennyson for less than 30 days, but go find a family and let's not put them into res. So we started with a pilot of 6 kids. 4 went to kin, 2 went to foster, 1 went to foster to adopt. And we built out this model. Denver County, if they just use this program instead of using our residential program, they will save $380,000 a year. So then the question is, what do you want to do with that money to get upstream to get fewer and fewer kids in? We've also been tracking, just last thing real quickly, we've been tracking spinoff impacts. So we've seen a 95% reduction in police contacts. That's a $75,000 savings a year. We've seen a 98% reduction in hospitalizations. That's a $297,000 a year savings. And so we're now sitting with legislators and Medicaid and saying, move money this way, you will get these results, liberate everyone, and we can get to a better place. 10 counties who are amazing. They are coordinating with public health, housing, other institutions that they've never done before. We are thrilled with the Colorado Partnership for Thriving Families. We are in complete sync coordination. That's the program you guys were talking about. So what you have is this amazing coordination and support to build out this continuum and to build out a new world where kids and families are not child welfare seen. And it generated so much excitement because people are talking about it, to be honest, and it is exciting that 5 states in the Children's Home Society of America network, North Carolina, Illinois, Florida, Mississippi, and Washington State have said, we're going to do rewiring too. So liberate people from the financial and programmatic constraints. Do not constrain yourself to evidence-based practices. It's a Linus blanket. They're needed, but it's evidence plus. And be driven by the outcome of fewer children and families in the child welfare system. Calculate the costs and go to budget writers, to Joint Budget Committee and superstars like Robin Smart. Go to federal level and say, stop buying bad outcomes this way. Invest this way. Spread it. Create new billing codes. And you will stop the flood into child welfare.
Wow.
It's so fun.
Where's the applause button? We don't have them on here, but that's right.
And that is just really powerful to me. So I am happy to have heard that. Suzanne, would you like to share a little bit about what you all are doing?
Sure. I'd love to. So I really don't have a whole lot of time to explain how prevention became a priority for me or how I got involved with this work. But I'll just say this, that I knew enough to actually ask my husband to run for governor in order to improve child welfare in our state. That was 100% my motivation. And I'll just end it at that. What came out of that was Bring Up Nebraska, which is a community-based prevention program that focuses on keeping families together and as many kids as possible in safe and loving homes. And with Bring Up Nebraska, the focus is local solutions. We've taken a really different approach where we no longer rely on that top-down, one-size-fits-all system that we had here, where basically the state makes all the decisions and just tells the local communities how to solve their problems. And instead, the focus is on local communities because we really believe that they are the best situated and most motivated to understand their own strengths and their own needs, and then the best to create the networks and solutions necessary there. So the core for Bring Up Nebraska is really that individual community. And within that community, the collaboratives come together and they're made up of nonprofit leaders and service providers, elected officials, business owners, healthcare providers, educators, law enforcement are a big part of it, community and church leaders, and of course, parents and youth. And from the beginning, each collaborative gets together and starts analyzing its specific issues, problems, and strengths based upon data that's provided by the Nebraska Children and Families Foundation and Casey Family Foundation. And that data is so important because that really drives what they're going to work for. So the collaboratives start talking and everyone starts talking about what they've been doing because so many times the folks were working in silos, not even knowing what other solutions were out there. And they start looking for gaps and overlaps in services. And then they develop the network strategies and long-term plans to work on those specific issues. Now, these could be on homelessness, the need for affordable housing, some work on graduation rates or third grade reading levels. It could be for the need for quality childcare, unemployment rates. We don't define or direct what those are. The communities decide. They're just given their metrics in comparison to the rest of the state. And then they start solving another problem and another problem. And the state partners are there with them, often sitting in the same meetings. And I won't go into all the list of agencies, but basically it's almost all of them, not just HHS. It's state and federal foundations and organizations that provide technical and financial support. It's Nebraska Children and Families Foundation that provides expertise, data, and resources. So everyone is sitting in there together, and all of us are there to support those communities. And sometimes we might provide expertise. And now we're excited to be a part of the Federal Thriving Families Safer Children Initiative. We have found motivation, inspiration, and resources to really push the program into becoming more comprehensive, that supports family and children with even more services and partners and addresses more systemic problems. You know, when I started this, I wasn't exactly shooting for the moon. I just kind of wanted to make things better. And many of the issues that we're working on can't be measured in 2 years because the communities are working on their own specific strategies and solutions. But one thing I can say is that Bring Up Nebraska in its first 2 years has decreased their home removal rates by 14% in 2 years. And that's no negative impact on the CFSR indicators. We have a long history of relying on removal from home as a chief tool in dealing with any kind of challenges that are going on within a family. And we're really starting to shift that. And that's the communities. That's because those communities are providing the upfront prevention services to help families before they get involved in child welfare and juvenile justice. So as I've said, Bring Up Nebraska and the collaboratives are about community well-being in order to care for kids and families. In 2019, the majority of our state experienced massive, devastating flooding, and the collaboratives were the groups that stepped up from the beginning with FEMA to manage those recovery efforts in their areas, to the point that FEMA said they had never seen any kind of work like this before. But it's because the collaboratives were already there working together. And now with COVID, again, the state has relied on them for information, leadership, and solutions. And I just can't overstate their impact. The work of the collaboratives has helped the governor direct CARES dollars. It's guided state leaders as we develop multiple task forces that deal with systemic issues, including mental health, food security, and housing. And these are long-term solutions. We really are building better because of these collaboratives. It's hard for me to believe that focusing on individuals in prevention is anything earth-shattering or that it would be have such a positive impact on Nebraska, but it really has been hard to explain how important this work has been. And I'm excited to be part of that Thriving Families, Safer Children initiative because now we can expand our work even more. And I hope that we can serve as an example, possibly a model for what can be achieved throughout the U.S. And if nothing else, we're here to spread the word that prevention works. And if you ever need anybody from Nebraska to help sell it, we're here because we can really talk about what's been achieved.
Thank you so much for all that concrete information and those powerful numbers that Ned shared. With that, I want to go to Ms. Bobby and ask, you know, can you talk about the site support teams that, you know, you work with and the role of parent and family leadership? You know, why is it important that we co-create with families in this work?
Yeah, so we could go into further dialogue. I want to be kind of short and quick, and I really want to focus on the importance of including families and lived experience. And I know this to be true, that families and lived experience are the secret sauce. And so when we're incorporating lived experience and families in a co-creation space, it's so important because they're going to be able to lift up the systems or the symptoms of broken system. For example, they're going to be able to provide a qualitative data that quantitative data is identifying. And a very tangible thing that I can use as an example is housing. So Nebraska's, it's known that there's a housing crisis right now. But when you incorporate lived experience into those spaces, those co-creation spaces of identifying that housing, you're going to get families that are going to come to the table and say, hey, listen, one of the barriers that we're really experiencing right now is the application fees. The application fees can come from $35 to $50. And with the family with a very tight budget, it's not really feasible to spend $200 on application fees. It just isn't going to work. When you're incorporating a lived experience person from a foster care lens, they're going to say, hey, we don't have credit and we don't have a family support system to really co-sign to get into housing. We don't have that support system and we're not financially capable of doing that. Another role with the lived experience is really demonstrating equity and inclusion in those spaces. When you look at a Nebraska table where a lot of system leaders are, they may not be affected by the disparities that a lived experience person is. And so lived experience can provide insight and perspective on those disparities. They're going to be able to speak to the disproportionate effects or marginalization or direct biases that they experience. And through inclusion of those perspectives, that's when we're really going to elevate and be able to create a community well-being system.
So, while you are hanging on to your seat with anticipation of the next conversation, don't worry. It continues in episode 4. Listen closely to their responses. Where do you hope to make the biggest impact? Listen to the rest of what this panel has to say about building a family well-being system in the next episode.